for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Nuclear negotiations take another turn as Iran's leader says the country's military sites would be off-limits to foreign inspectors. Cuba gets a seat at the summit of the Americas in Panama, and Iran sends warships to the Gulf of Aden off the coast of Yemen. Here for this week's top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, Michael Hirsch of Politico, Indira Lakshmanan of Bloomberg News, and Jeff Dyer of the Financial Times. I do welcome your calls, questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And it's good to see you all.
Happy Friday.
Nice to be here.
Good to see you. Indira, in addition to the Iranian leader saying military sites would be strictly off limits, he says that Iran will only sign the deal if the sanctions are lifted that same day. Where do we go from here?
Look, I think part of this is about messaging on both sides. And one thing that President Rouhani said, which really echoed what the United States has said, is deals that are win-lose don't last. And a deal can only work if it's win-win for both sides. This is a question, I think, of everyone having to package it as win for us and not for them. And so even if Iran did agree to everything that was in the U.S. published framework, the parameters that we saw a week ago in Lausanne, which frankly, most of the reporters who we were there covering Lausanne were amazed that if the United States actually got them to agree to all of those points on that five-page list, wow, pretty impressive if they did. But I think it's a case of everyone trying to highlight what's good for them. So there, you know, it's about language too. You can say we're going to have all sanctions lifted if the other side says we agree that as soon as you implement this, everything is going to be lifted. So everyone can use the language in the way they want it. I think, you know, this is a three-month period in which both Rouhani and Khamenei in Iran and Obama and Kerry in the United States have to sell it to the skeptics in their respective countries. And so why wouldn't you put the best possible face on it? That doesn't necessarily mean that this can't be resolved.
Jeff.
This could also, it's about language, but it could also be about leverage as well. This allows the Iranian negotiators to go into the next session with the U.S. and Europeans and sit down and say, well, you know, the supreme leader, he's not quite there yet, so you're going to have to be a bit more flexible with us. You're going to have to give us a bit more. And so the fact that he said these things about sanctions and said these things about inspections of military sites gives them some leverage in the next round of talks.
Yeah, I mean, the only surprise here, I think, is that it took this long to hear the backlash from the hardliners, which U.S. negotiators were expecting, led, of course, by Ayatollah Khamenei himself. And as Jeff said, this is both the hardliners speaking, saying, you know, we're putting you on a very short leash, and issuing their so-called red lines to the negotiators as they negotiate until June 30th, you know, about what the law is.
So you will all see it as mostly tactical.
I think it's to a large degree tactical. I mean, let's not pretend that these same arguments didn't come up in the negotiating room over all those weeks we were in Lausanne. Of course they did. So this is not new to anybody. I mean, this is, again, about putting out your message publicly.
Sure.
And there was an interesting difference, a nuance between what Khamenei, the supreme leader, said and what Rouhani, the president, said. The supreme leader said sanctions have to be lifted on day one. And Rouhani said sanctions have to be lifted when the deal is implemented. And so that is a difference. It really is. And it allows them some wiggle room. But, you know, you get back into all these complications about the so-called snapback functions. One thing that I thought was incredibly interesting was how the Russians apparently are the ones who came up with this idea of creating a whole new United Nations resolution that would sort of enshrine the deal once it's done, if it gets done. But in the same breath of that new resolution, lift the other ones but keep proliferation mitigation measures in place. So there are all sorts of sort of neat ways, workarounds of making this work that everyone saves face and everyone gets something of what they want.
And it's a reminder that ultimately this is about politics, politics here and inside Iran. As hard a time as Obama and Kerry are going to have selling this deal to the U.S., to Israel, to our Congress, with a threat of new sanctions that could scupper the deal on Capitol Hill, it's probably going to be even harder for Rouhani and Javad Zarif, the Iranian foreign minister, to sell this to their own hardliners, the al-Quds force. And that's the real task here.
Interesting that you had a crowd chanting death to America when Khamenei spoke.
It's almost like it's precisely designed to make the U.S. Congress and the Israelis on edge. I mean, that's almost the worst sort of messaging that could come across at this moment. That makes a much harder sell for the U.S. But the flip side of this was the other crowd that you had when Zarif came back to Tehran last week after signing the agreement in Lausanne. And that's, in a sense, the real leverage that the U.S. and the West have in these negotiations is the huge expectations within Iran from middle-class, working-class people in Iran who want a deal to be done, who want Iran to become more of a normal country and want an end to sanctions. And that's the real leverage. That's the pressure on the Iranian regime is from that crowd.
I was so interested that John Brennan, the CIA director, said it was Rouhani who came to him having talked to Khamenei explaining how serious Iran's situation is.
That's right. And he gave a speech at Harvard this week where he gave some insight into what the U.S. intelligence community thinks the Iranians have thought about this process over the last couple of years since Rouhani was elected. And the phrase he used, I think, was that he said that Rouhani went to Khamenei and said that the economy was destined to go down if they didn't do a deal. Now, this is kind of interesting politics, the way that phrase could play out in the U.S. I mean, on one hand, that might strengthen the argument of some people like Benjamin Netanyahu, who would say, well, if we put more sanctions on them, put more pressure on them, we'll get a better deal. But then other people might say, well, this is what we wanted. What we have got Iran in the place we wanted them to be because we have Rouhani now in power who is prepared to make that argument to the supreme leader. And that's actually what we really wanted to do. And more sanctions will not actually change that in any way. We have them in the place we want them to be.
There's huge elite pressure within Iran for getting a deal done because it's not just an economic question, but Iranians also don't want to be isolated from the world. And the sanctions are merely sort of a manifestation, a public face of the isolation that has become so deep, not just since the 1979 revolution, but really in the last several years. You know, the United Nations sanctions started in 2006. The U.S. sanctions started getting really serious in 2010. And their economy has not only gone down the drain, but it's been hard for Iranians to do anything. Keep in mind that the banking sanctions have made it almost impossible, even for legitimate trade that is not sanctioned by anybody. Food, trade, that kind of thing has made it really hard for that to get done. I thought it was really interesting how the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, the IRGC, the head of their organization, which is a military group that is backing Hezbollah and all sorts of, you know, terrorist groups around the world, not to mention backing Assad in Syria, they came out saying, this is good. Congratulations to Zarif on this deal. So there are forces who want it in Iran.
So, Michael, what happens now?
Well, we have this very intense three-month period leading up to the June 30th deadline, which may or may not hold. We know that to get this interim deal, they went 2 days beyond the deadline. And I think both sides think the stakes are such that, you know, it wouldn't kill them if they had to go beyond the June 30th deadline. But this is when all of the blanks are filled in. And that means, you know, what kinds of inspections at which facilities and a lot of the things. I mean, the interim deal that was announced last week was surprisingly detailed, I must say. No one expected to hear that. But now we see this being finalized and coming, and this is getting back to the tensions Indira was just talking about, coming at a time when there's a virtual proxy war going on between Iran and the United States in Yemen, with the U.S. and Saudi backing one side, Iran backing the other side, and numerous other tensions, and Benjamin Netanyahu, the newly reelected prime minister of Israel, continuing his very powerful campaign against this deal. So pressures here are enormous. It's going to be a very intense time.
What happens with the U.S. Congress after that?
After June 30th or
yes,
over the next couple of weeks?
No, after June 30th.
Well, that kind of partly depends on what happens between now and then. I mean, obviously, Congress comes back next week. It's going to take up the so-called Corker Bill, which gives Congress the right to either say yes or no to any final deal. There's a lot of haggling about the fine print of that legislation going at the moment, and that will be one of the big stories in Washington next week. But I think what we see coming out of this is a recognition from the administration that in some shape or form, Congress is going to have a vote on an Iran deal. And so the real issue for the administration now is whether Congress is going to vote on terms that are really poisonous, the negotiations, or whether it's a more simple, straight vote on the terms of the deal that doesn't have any legally binding implication for the negotiations. It's about the fine print now.
And President Obama has essentially acknowledged that Congress is going to have this role with the telephone calls that he's had this week. He was on the phone with Bob Corker, the Republican chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who authored this bill about congressional oversight, trying to convince him, trying to say, you know, this is why we don't want you to do the bill as it currently is. I'm sure he's trying to convince him that if he is going to put something out, to have it be in wording that the president prefers. Similarly, Ben Cardin, the Democrat, is also working that problem very hard.
Indira Lakshmanan, diplomatic correspondent for Bloomberg News. Short break here. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from America's Natural Gas. Learn how Denver International Airport is committed to lowering emissions by heating its terminal and fueling hundreds of vehicles with natural gas at thinkaboutit.org. From CFP, on behalf of certified financial planner professionals, committed to the highest standard in personal financial advice to help plan for major life events and reaching financial goals at letsmakeaplan.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
Welcome back to the International Hour of our Friday News Roundup. This week with Michael Hirsch. He's national editor for Politico. He is the author of At War with Ourselves, Why America is Squandering Its Chance to Build a Better World. Indira Lakshmanan is diplomatic correspondent for Bloomberg News. Jeff Dyer is with the Financial Times and author of The Contest of the Century, The New Era of Competition with China. We do welcome your calls, questions, comments. Here is one from Charles in Houston, Texas, that takes us right into our next subject, and that's Yemen. Iran is denying supporting the Houthi fighters in Yemen. Is there any doubt?
One of the most decisive comments this week was from John Kerry, who really for the first time for a U.S. government official came out and very clearly said that Iran was supplying weapons to the Houthi rebels in Yemen. This has been a kind of controversial subject really for the last few months as the Houthis, you know, they took over the capital last year and they've been slowly heading south in recent months. And they've always been had connections with the Iranians. There's always been a sense of Iranian influence. But what we've started to see over the last few months is growing evidence of a much more direct influence from the Iranians, with actual weapons and other types of intelligence support being given to the rebels.
And that takes us to Charles' question. He says, if the claim that Iran is backing the Houthi rebels in Yemen is true, then what is Iran's strategic interest in doing so? Michael.
Well, Iran would like to see this as part of a larger Sunni-Shia struggle, Iran representing the Shia. Saudi Arabia, perhaps the most powerful sponsor of the Sunni side in this supposed conflict. And I say supposed because it really is not that in Yemen. I mean, Yemen is a very complex situation, largely local. The Houthi rebels are getting aid, no doubt, from Iran, but they also have their own grievances. It's important to remember that among those who are fighting with the Houthis now against the ousted president are militants who are with the former president, Saleh, who was a U.S. ally until he was ousted, just to show you how complicated the situation really is. And so I think the Iranian strategic objective is to turn this into part of its larger effort, which includes, of course, funding and underwriting Hezbollah, you know, in Lebanon and doing what it's doing elsewhere in terms of Hamas in Palestine. But we should be extremely wary of signing onto, or I should say joining in with this Iranian strategic concept, we the U.S.
Well, and Iran is now sending warships to Yemen.
That's right. It dispatched a naval destroyer and a support vessel on Wednesday. And this is at the same time that the United States is increasing its weapons supply to the Saudis, who are on the other side, you know, trying to put down the Houthi rebels. But as Michael said, it's extremely complicated because the Houthis not only are allied with the ousted president, the previously ousted president of Yemen, not the latest ousted president, who was, remember, a U.S. ally in the fight against al-Qaeda. But al-Qaeda and the Arabian Peninsula, which is, according to the United States, the most dangerous arm of al-Qaeda right now, with big designs on Western targets, really wanting to do something within the U.S. homeland, the Houthis are also trying to fight against them. So there are really cross alliances. And even though the Iranians and the Saudis have in some ways pitched it as a proxy war between Sunnis and Shias, as Michael said, with Iranians as the leaders of the Shia and the Saudis as the leaders of the Sunni, but it's much more complicated than that.
Well, but if you've got Secretary of State Kerry negotiating with Iran on this nuclear arms deal and at the same time warning Iran not to get involved in this Yemen, he said there would be consequences. Now, what kinds of consequences?
Well, what we're starting to see in the last couple of months is, in parallel to the Iran negotiations, the U.S. is trying to put back together the series of alliances it had with, if you like, the Sunni autocrats. So you've seen in the last couple of weeks that the U.S. is now giving military aid again back to Egypt after the military coup a couple of years ago. And now you see the U.S. supporting the Saudis in this battle in Yemen. And so what you're seeing is an attempt, if you like, to counterbalance Iranian influence. So on the one hand, trying to solve the narrow nuclear issue, but realizing that actually could strengthen Iran in lots of ways. And so the U.S. has to do other things to try and balance and push back against Iran. There is no easy way out of this. There is no sort of silver bullet that can solve all these problems.
And it has to work on both fronts. Ayatollah denouncing the Saudi-led airstrikes,
right.
Michael.
Right. And also bear in mind that both inside Iraq and Syria, where a raid against ISIS, and in Yemen, where, as Indira said, the biggest concern, according to Ashton Carter, the defense secretary, in remarks he made this week, is the rise of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Effectively, we're kind of working with Iran. I mean, and that just shows you how difficult this is. With one hand, we are helping and giving intelligence to the Saudis in their efforts inside Yemen because it's on their southern border. They're very worried about the rise of Shia influence. The other hand, you know, we're not that worried about the rise of Shia influence because those Shia forces are arrayed against the most dangerous al-Qaeda-linked groups that are considered a U.S. terrorist threat.
And you've got Pakistan's parliament deciding it's going to stay neutral.
That's right. That's right. That's the latest thing we saw. There are other big problems going on in Pakistan right now. But, you know, they're focused on some of those others. But right now they're going to stay neutral on this. I mean, they've got their troops involved in Waziristan. They've got their own problems with al-Qaeda and the Taliban that they have to deal with before they get distracted. But I wanted to say, I don't think we're necessarily working with Iran. I'd say we're working in parallel, doing some of the same things that Iran is doing in terms of, as Michael said, against ISIS and against al-Qaeda and the Arabian Peninsula. But no one in the U.S. administration would ever concede that we're working with them. And that's why we see John Kerry speaking out so much against them. I want to say that Yemen came up in the talks about the nuclear question in Lausanne. So John Kerry did acknowledge that all of these issues come up, but they've tried very much to keep them separate. They've said these are talks just about the nuclear issue. They're not about regional influence. They're not about Syria. They're not about Yemen. But, of course, it comes up, even if it's just
a
passing remark.
Of course it
does. I mean, the campaign against Tikrit, ISIS-held Tikrit, may have been one of the most bizarre ever in military history. Why? It began almost without U.S. knowledge or say-so by al-Quds force, that is Iranian-backed Shia militias, backed also by the Iraqi government, against the ISIS-held town, and was followed on by separate U.S. airstrikes, okay, that were not apparently in any way coordinated with Iran, because we're not coordinated. I mean, and yet, somehow, at least for the moment, it appears to have succeeded in that what was effectively a U.S.-Iranian effort, backed effort, has ousted ISIS from Tikrit. So it just shows you just how incredibly complex the politics are here.
So we have become extremely concerned about possible attacks on the homeland, and it would seem that the chaos in Yemen is even upping that more.
Absolutely. I mean, the al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, the al-Qaeda affiliate there, and these al-Qaeda franchise, they feed on instability, they feed on chaos. And this kind of civil conflict that you have in a country like Yemen, the collapse of the state institutions, collapse of the government, collapse of the military, is exactly the kind of situation where they can feed on, where they can grow, where they can gain territory and have more space to do what they want to do, which is in some ways to plan attacks on the West.
All right, so now we move on to the summit of the Americas. How significant an event is this, Jeff?
Well, this has turned out to be a very significant event because it's become a sort of keystone in the U.S. rapprochement with Cuba. President Obama talked last year with Raul Castro from Cuba at the time when he announced his plan to normalize relations. He's met him very briefly once before. They shook hands in 2013 at Nelson Mandela's funeral. But this will be, and they're not going to have a formal meeting at this summit this weekend, but they are going to have some sort of chat.
Apparently, they spoke on the phone last night, Michael.
Yeah, which was actually a little strange, knowing that they were going to have a sit-down summit, why they would need to do that. So we need to hear more about what that was about. But clearly, this is a big part of what Obama wants to leave as his legacy. And this includes Iran, too. Thawing relations with longtime adversaries. Clearly, that seems to be happening now with the Castro brothers, Fidel and Raul, as eager to do it as Obama apparently is. I think one of the strange ironies here, though, and this is where one of the key points of tension at this Summit of the Americas, is that in an odd way, Venezuela has become the new Cuba. You have Nicolas Maduro, the president of that country, of course, the heir to Hugo Chavez, who died, and turning America into the sort of great Satan, if you will, of this hemisphere for Venezuela. And he's only at 25% approval rating, but he's using a lot of the anti-American rhetoric and sanctions that have been placed against him. And he's generating sympathy even now at the summit against the United States, which is interesting.
And early on, Cuba joined in with that criticism of the U.S. for naming seven individuals in Venezuela as being somehow terrorist persons. And now, are we going to see Cuba back away from Venezuela?
Well, I think Cuba has been quieter than you might have expected, and certainly quieter than they would have been 1 or 2 years ago about the same situation. I mean, part of this, though, is about technicality, again, of language. In order to impose sanctions on foreign, you know, members of a foreign government, the language in U.S. legislation or in executive orders involves calling someone a national security threat. So we saw Ben Rhodes, a top aide to the president, trying to back away from that this week and saying, you know, we don't actually consider Venezuela a national security threat to the United States. But, you know, it's kind of sanctions can be, a kind of blunt instrument. And if the language requires you to do that, you put it in there. But I want to look at the bigger picture, which is that it was President Bill Clinton who 21 years ago was instrumental in organizing the first summit of the Americas. And 21 years later, this is the first summit that Cuba is attending. That's big. That's very big, because the United States had blocked Cuba all these years from attending. And the fact that it's not only opening the door but encouraging them to come has made a lot of other countries in Latin America very pleased, because they've not been part of this. They've not wanted to take sides on the U.S.-Cuba dispute that's lasted half a century.
So, in other words, what you're saying is that President Obama is signaling that he wants the whole of Latin America to be part of the U.S. interest.
Very much so. And this is going to help the United States, has already helped the United States in other ways throughout the hemisphere. Because you see countries who have been, you know, on the fence about the United States saying, gee, this is really good. We would like to see this rapprochement between Cuba and the United States. And, you know, it's true that Venezuela has sort of become, I don't want to call it a sideshow, but it has become something that has taken attention away. But I think the big picture is Cuba going to be taken off the state sponsors of terrorism list, where there are only four countries on that list? And I think that it was a foregone conclusion once they announced this review that it was going to be taken off. But that's something that's critical, because it prevents Cuba from doing banking, for example, even here with its interest section in Washington.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Now, Jeff Dyer, what would removing Cuba from the terror list mean for U.S.-Cuba relations?
It's partly practical, partly symbolic. I mean, the symbolic fact is, as Indira mentioned, you know, there are four countries on this list. It's people like Iran and Syria. It's a stain on the reputation of the Cubans. And to get off that list is part of their view of becoming a more normal country and having a more normal relationship with the U.S. It's practical implications as well, because it's part of this, you know, very complex framework of sanctions and laws that the U.S. has set up in Cuba that makes it very hard for U.S. banks and U.S. companies to really genuinely do business, to actually, you know, transfer money in and out of Cuba. And this is, by taking that away, this is one of the things that will actually free up companies to be able to transact more with Cuba.
So what do the latest sanctions on Venezuela mean as far as the summit of the Americas?
Well, as I mentioned, Maduro is, you know, using this as a sort of, you know, his own private cause against the Americans at the summit. But it's a very serious targeting of senior, Venezuelan officials. Continues, obviously, to affect the oil market, although Venezuela has less weight there, as we've seen in recent months with the drop in oil prices. I think it's evidence that the U.S. perhaps perceives that it needs at least one enemy in this hemisphere, and that Venezuela is going to replace Cuba in that sense, and Maduro appears to be justifying that.
Yeah,
I mean, a couple of things. I mean, the first thing to say is that the backstory here is that Venezuela is imploding; its economy is in freefall. There's a reasonable chance the country might default sometime in the next couple of years, and you could have a very severe political crisis here. That's one of the reasons why the Cubans have been quite keen to open ties with the U.S., because Cuba has benefited for the last 15 years from a huge economic aid from Venezuela. It knows that that's not going to be there anymore. It can see what's happening in Venezuela, so it needs to readdress its options. That's one part of it. The second part, I think, was very interesting that Michael said that, you know, Venezuela has become the new Cuba. It's in some ways become the new Cuba in American politics. I mean, these sanctions have been driven by a new anti-Chavez Venezuelan community based in Miami, who have all come here over the last decade. They've got themselves organized. They saw what the Cubans did. They've linked up with many of the very same South Florida politicians who've always pushed the Cuba sanctions, Senator Marco Rubio, Eliana Ross Lettinen. And so you're seeing as well the influence of the sort of anti-Castro Cuban community, while its political influence is fading, the anti-Chavez, anti-Maduro Venezuelan community is now starting to have some kind of influence on American politics.
Yeah, it's very interesting because this long time and very powerful anti-Cuba, anti-Castro lobby, based in Miami, but, you know, very influential in Washington, has kind of given up the ghost on this deal. The polls show that there is consistent support for it. The latest Marist College poll showed 59% support for the Cuba thaw. And so I think that's what you're seeing. You're seeing a replacement of one adversary for another because the anti-Cuba lobby is basically dying.
I think it'll be really interesting to see what Marco Rubio, who's going to be entering the presidential race, what is he going to do with this? Because remember, in the aftermath of the December 17th surprise announcement that the United States and Cuba were going to work together to reestablish diplomatic relations after a year and a half of secret talks, Marco Rubio, you know, was so upset, a Cuban-American, you know, whose family was, you know, repressed under Castro, that he said, I don't care if 99% of the American people support this, I am going to be against it. Since then, he's been more measured in Senate hearings, but let's see what he does as a candidate.
All right, short break here. When we come back, we'll open the phones. We'll also talk about Kenya, its bombing of the Al-Shabaab camps in Somalia.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. From Novo Nordisk, committed to programs that offer life coaching and career counseling to eligible members of the hemophilia and bleeding disorders community, and to supporting World Hemophilia Day on April 17th. Learn more at mynovosecure.com. And the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a better life. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org.
Her heart wasn't beating. She was blue, cold, and lifeless. And 3 hours after her heart had first stopped, it begins to beat again.
On the next Fresh Air, Dr. Kevin Fong, author of Extreme Medicine, discusses medical advances resulting from treating patients exposed to extreme cold, heat, trauma, outer space, and the ocean's depths. Join us.
And it's time to open the phones. Let's go first to Titusville, Florida. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Great program. I'd like to revisit the Iranian question for a moment. I think when the commentators suggest that the sanctions were effective on the economy, that's absolutely correct. I don't think there's any doubt about that. However, to suggest that the sanctions were somehow effective in affecting the development of the Iranian nuclear plans, I think is absolutely off base, incorrect, historically inaccurate. I believe when it was probably President Bush in 06 or 08, when they put the sanctions on, we hardened and the Iraqis hardened their positions, such that initially they may have had 5,000 centrifuges. Currently they're talking about 22,000. Initially they may have had 300. pounds of low-grade uranium. Now they've got 300 kilograms. Now they've got over 20,000 kilograms. And they ended up, of course, having better centrifuges, which only goes, I think, to say that when you have a nation as, you know, as large with as brilliant a cadre of scientists, that they're going to be able to move ahead regardless of what kinds of sanctions we put on them, simply because their resolve will harden in accordance with our own. I think
the caller is absolutely right. I mean, sanctions have obviously created huge problems for the Iranian economy, and they will have created some technical problems for the Iranian nuclear program, but they certainly haven't stopped the nuclear program. As the caller mentioned, year after year, even under these very intense sanctions, Iran was able to increase the number of centrifuges, to expand its nuclear infrastructure to quite a substantial degree. So sanctions are a tactic, but they're not a strategy to overcoming this issue.
All right, to Megan in Knoxville, Tennessee. You're on the air.
Yes, I have a comment and a question.
Sure.
I'm a supporter of Israel. I do, however, find it a little disturbing that it seems like a Congress elected by the people of the United States, a lot of whom have no ties to Israel, have to check with the prime minister of another country before they can formulate their position, which tends to be right with him. And I wonder, you know, the psychology of his life. And I think, you know, he was in the military and had some bad experiences. And some of the ones in Congress, you know, some of the older hawks, I just feel like that in Iran, there's a young generation who wants to open up to us. They don't believe like the older revolutionaries. And here, a lot of us have not been traumatized by that. And I feel like we're just creating the next cycle unless we can break out of that attitude. And the media doesn't help because it's like, how does Israel feel about this? Well, you know, there are a lot of other people involved in the situation in Israel. I think we should pay attention to that. And third, they're nuclear scientists. I'm not sure that I want Bibi Netanyahu critiquing a nuclear deal and nobody asking the professionals. You know, all these people, if they had cancer or something, they would go to a doctor.
All right.
Yeah, I mean, the caller puts her finger on a main fault line between the administration and Congress over the Iran deal, over Israel, which is, you know, a fallacy, as some would say, of completely identifying U.S. national interests with Israeli national interests, which Netanyahu wants to do, and many people think is not the right way to go. I mean, this is a prime minister who is a brilliant politician who brazenly came here as an electoral ploy, frankly, to speak to the U.S. Congress and to show the voters back in Israel that he was the only guy who could handle Iran. I mean, I don't think anyone would really deny that that was Netanyahu's main purpose coming on the cusp of his election as prime minister, and it was a successful ploy. So I think the caller makes some important cautionary points. Let's not misidentify U.S. interests with Israeli interests.
Do you think his speech here in the United States in any way backfired in Deira?
Well, I think that it hardened or it boosted Democratic support for the president in Congress, because there were Democrats who were very, very willing to go along with the Corker bill, to go along with the Kirk Menendez bill, meaning impose new sanctions or impose congressional oversight on any Iran deal, who suddenly, when Netanyahu showed up in Congress, their backs were up because they felt like, who are you to come here against our president's wishes and do this on the eve of an election, feeling much the same way that the caller did. And I think that that has solidified Democratic support for the president, which is going to make it harder for the people who are boosting those bills to get a veto-proof majority. So in
Sure.
that respect, I think it hurt his cause.
Absolutely, I agree. I mean, it clearly galvanized all of the Republican opposition to the Iran deal. But for a lot of the centrist Democrats who were uneasy about the Iran negotiations, it made it much harder for them to openly oppose the president, because they didn't want to look as if they're doing so because the leader of a foreign country told them to do so.
Interesting. All right, let's go to Mumtaz in St. Louis, Missouri. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, this is Mumtaz Lalani. Our comments regarding sanction. I mean, we tried sanction for 50 years on Cuba. It didn't work. And now I think Obama did the best thing to, you know, have a relationship with Cuba, 90 miles off the shore of Florida country. And Republicans are all, you know, jumping up and down about that. Same thing, the Republicans, they want sanctions for Iran and a kind of, they are beating a war drum. They should learn their lesson that, you know, you can't just put anybody on a corner and expect that they will fell down on their knees. You know, you are just pushing people on the corners using those sanctions and dreaming those war drums.
Well, I think he's absolutely right that, I mean, history shows us that 50 years of sanctions on Cuba, pretty much unilateral sanctions from the United States, haven't worked in the sense that they haven't changed the Cuban government. So I think that's a fact. And there are few cases in history where sanctions can be proven to have gotten the outcome we wanted. People use South Africa as an example, all of the divestment movement as changing the mind of the South African government. But that was a government, let's keep in mind, that was already very internationally connected and didn't want to be isolated. With Iran, I think it's a different thing, though. We weren't using the sanctions as an end. The United States was trying to use the sanctions as a means to force Iran back to the negotiating table. The Obama administration says that worked. They're back at the negotiating table. So now let's get the deal we want, and sanctions can then be eased.
I think with Cuba and Iran, you have a demonstration, a practical demonstration of, on one end of the spectrum, sanctions that don't work at all, that in fact have the opposite effect, which are unilateral sanctions like the ones we placed on Cuba, versus effective multilateral sanctions in the case of getting the Iranians to the table. So, you know, it's an interesting
point.
All right,
to William in Gainesville, Florida, you're on the air.
The reason I call, Diane, is that we're having all this discussion about preventing the Iranians from getting a nuclear device. I've been in the Army. I've had top-secret clearances. I've dealt with the Russians. And I can tell you that I think we need to assume that they have a nuclear weapon. I mean, the pancake is available from the old Soviet supplies, the North Koreans, and a high school physics major could build a nuclear device. And I think in the next several months, all of a sudden, we're going to find this out, and everybody's going to be shocked.
Jeff, what do you think?
Well, I think a couple of points there. I mean, the first thing is that it is a reality that Iran is virtually a threshold nuclear power. It has built up the substantial nuclear infrastructure. It's pretty close, if not, it's not just there just yet. But to the questioner's second point, the thing about this nuclear deal would be to ask the question, would you feel more comfortable with the current situation where we have little visibility of what's going on in Iran, or would you feel more comfortable about doing a deal which at least puts inspectors in the country for 25 years and gives you maybe some chance of finding of spotting an Iranian attempt to sneak to a nuclear weapon?
Here's the question lots of people are asking. What if Iran does have a nuclear weapon? We know Israel has nuclear weapons. North Korea has its nuclear weapons. What will happen? And then Saudi Arabia, and perhaps Saudi Arabia already has them.
Well, that is the fear.
I
mean, the fear, Saudi Arabia almost certainly does not yet have them. Saudi Arabia is keenly interested in getting them if Iran does develop a nuclear weapon. And this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, which is the Sunni-Shia tensions in that region. You really do not want the most volatile region in the world to become fully nuclearized. It is true that Israel probably has more than 100 nuclear weapons, but they have sort of remained out of play. So I think the key here, and this gets back to what the caller was saying, is not so much to dismantle Iran's entire nuclear program. We've given up on that hope. But to prevent a breakout and to keep it at what U.S. officials are saying, perhaps somewhat optimistically, is a year before Iran, under this deal, would be allowed to actually or could practically develop a nuclear weapon.
And one point that, I mean, all the nuclear scientists have made is that you can't bomb knowledge. Even if the U.S. or Israel were to try to bomb this program out of existence, which would be very dangerous with regard to the Arak heavy water reactor, is just one example, but you can't bomb the knowledge out of the heads of these Iranian nuclear scientists, many of whom, let's point out, have been assassinated over the years, supposedly with the involvement of Mossad. But what the U.S. administration is trying trying to do is what John Kerry repeatedly refers to as cutting off the four paths that Iran would have to nuclear weapons. So he's talking about uranium, plutonium. He's talking about the covert path. You know, he's talking about the, sort of every possible way that they could get a nuclear weapon is what they're trying to cut off. Now, by having UN inspectors in the country, as Jeff said, not only for 25 years in some cases, going from the whole life cycle of uranium, from the mines and the mills for a very long time, they're also now using this term a forever deal. Because if Iran were to implement the additional protocol and some other measures under the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, it would give the IAEA access forever to parts of Iran. So the question is, how, as Jeff says, I think it's, do you have more security if you have more eyes and more visibility on that program and inspectors everywhere?
All right, let's talk about Kenya and its bombing of al-Shabaab camps in Somalia this week. Was this retaliation for last week's massacre at the Kenyan University?
Well, certainly the Kenyans are saying so. And Kenya bears some responsibility here because the putative leader, a man whose pseudonym is Mohamed Mohamed, is Kenyan, a former Kenyan school teacher, in fact. This is clearly a retaliation for this horrific attack that left 148 people dead by a group, al-Shabaab, largely based in Somalia, that claims to want to kill Christians, although they seem to end up killing more Muslims than Christians on their various terror forays, including the Westbrook Mall a few years ago.
So what is al-Shabaab trying to gain from these attacks in Kenya?
I think part of it is visibility, because remember, you know, there's a sort of war out there for prominence among all these extremist groups. I mean, we have seen where Boko Haram has aligned itself outright with ISIS, even though they're not really on the same continent. So I think that al-Shabaab is trying to raise its profile. As Michael said, they have killed more than 400 people in Kenya in the last 2 years. Most of them have been Muslims. Part of this is now meant to be an intentional attack against Christians. We heard that at Garissa University that after initially opening fire indiscriminately, they were later pulling out students, identifying who was Christian, assassinating those students, letting some of the Muslims free. They're trying to create a new profile for themselves.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Meanwhile, the government is certainly taking lots of criticism about its security procedures.
Absolutely, and that's the other context to these, you know, these Kenyan air raids into Somalia this week. There have been wide-scale protests at other universities around the country with students saying, you know, you have to do much more to protect us from these kind of dangers. And also there's a lot of criticism about the response of the Kenyan military to the attack at Garissa University. Some people saying that they're very late to respond, that they took a long time to get involved. So that's the political backwash that the Kenyan government is facing this week from this horrible attack.
So you have the Kenyan president calling for 100,000 new police, new troops to guard all of these facilities, but apparently corruption is so embedded in that process. How is that going to work?
And you've also had Kenyan politicians talking about setting up a wall on the border between Kenya and Somalia as well. It really feels like a country that's really sort of scratching around for solutions to a very hard problem, because, as Michael mentioned, there are lots of cases of, you know, Kenyan soldiers and other Kenyans getting involved in this group. It's a very porous border. Lots of alienated young Kenyans seeking some sort of identity with al-Shabaab. There's no silver bullet that the Kenyans can use that will solve this problem for them.
All right. Here's an email from Judy in Mayfield Heights, Ohio. She says, Iran says its economy is in trouble, but it's still sending money to Hezbollah and other terrorist groups for them to obtain weapons. Michael.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the U.S. economy is in trouble, and we still have, you know, a $500 billion defense budget. An economy in trouble run by autocrats, as in Iran, does not prevent you from, you know, misusing funds. Although I will say that the underwriting of the Hezbollah in particular, I think, has been reduced in the region in the last several years. It's not clear, you know, how much money there and aid and equipment they're actually sending to the Houthi rebels in Yemen. So it's difficult to quantify that. But Iran remains, despite the sanctions, an oil-wealthy country, which has allowed it to defy, you know, the economic effect of the sanctions.
All right. One last caller from Rockville, Maryland. Thomas, you're on the air.
Hi. Good morning, all. After the revolution in Iran, has there been any time that Iran has directly threatened the interests of us, like USA? We know that some of our friends, like Saudi Arabia, has links to al-Qaeda. I mean, they've funded some of the there are links that show that the funding is coming from them.
Indeed. What is your response, Jeff?
Well, I think the Iranian government would say that Iran has been challenging U.S. interests pretty much constantly around the regions for all that time, whether it's through, you know, Hezbollah and Hamas, whether it's through more recently in its involvement in the Syrian civil war, with Iran's behavior after the invasion of Iraq by the U.S. And its allies in 2003. I mean, there's a whole series of cases where U.S. and Iranian interests have been fairly firmly in conflict.
And those prisoners held for so long until Ronald Reagan came into office. Jeff Dyer of the Financial Times, Indira Lakshmanan of Bloomberg News, and Michael Hirsch of Politico. Thank you all. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Diane.
Thanks. And thanks all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Timothy Olmsted. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts.